This is side two of tape two. You're talking about President McPherson, right. And then looking right. back at some of the other administrators.
Right. In the 14 years that I worked for Jack Breslin, I had the relationship with Jack was basically, you go take care of it and call me if you need help. I mean, I can remember, it rings in my ears to this day, one of the earliest, if not the earliest, direction I had from Jack when I started to work for him was, these are our people, take care of them. And that was, I mean, I remember that, it was clearly a more paternalistic kind of system, but if you knew Jack Breslin, it was clearly Jack Breslin, too. I mean, Jack Breslin was revered by the common employee of this campus. I mean, he could walk across campus and converse with a gardener or with a custodial or with a faculty member. I mean, he was, that's the kind of person he was. And he really meant that. But his position with me was that, you know, this is your area, this is your professional area. He was busy with the lobbying down at the legislature and so on. And so, you know, I can remember I had one staff meeting with Jack Breslin where he called his whole staff together. In all the years I worked for him, basically it was a one-on-one kind of thing where you called him if you needed help, and generally it was you calling him. I mean, you basically ran your area. When I switched then to report to Roger Wilkinson for, I think, 13 years for Roger, that was a different model. And in that case, Roger had four assistant vice presidents, and we met every other week for almost the whole morning, and it became much more of a team kind of thing. We had housing and food, physical plant, the finance area, and the human resource area were the four assistants. So there was much more planning and collaboration across the whole operational side of the university. Also, during those years, what had been around for years as the operations committee really became much more formalized and more active, and to this day has grown more, has more people on it, is a broader group. And it would be, you have the dean's group that meets with the provost and the president. Well, this would be the people on the operational side, equal to, in effect, in many ways, to the dean's group. And they get together monthly and meet and coordinate across the operational side of the university. And that became much more evolved into a more important organization over the years. With the change in presidents, and every president has a different style, every president has, as every person does, their strengths and their weaknesses, and you learn to adapt to the presidents. I mean, they don't adapt to you, and you're used in different ways. Some presidents simply say, you know, you're the expert in this area, take care of it, keep me informed, it's a very collegial kind of relationship, and rank doesn't necessarily mean a lot as far as your title and so on. Other presidents, it's a much more micromanaged, top-down kind of setting, and you don't have the same kind of feeling as being dealt with as a professional as much as you do as a technician, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, but you know, that's the way things are, and people change, and even presidents change. You know, they start one way, and then they, as the years go by, they change to become a different way based on the reality of the situation.
Is there any of the presidents that you've worked with that you found that it's been most easy to work with? or that you enjoyed the most?
Well, for different reasons. I mean, some of them were very short term, you know, like Ed Hardin, mm-hmm. and Gordon Guyer and so on. But Gordon and I had been friends for years and years as faculty members because we have a lot of conservation and outdoor interests and so on. And so, you know, when he was president, he was still Gordon, and he's to this day, we're still friends. Mm-hmm. Cecil Mackey probably, well, Cliff Wharton was easy to work with, but there weren't a lot of years, but he was easy to work with. But I worked a lot with Jack Breslin at that time. When Cecil came on board, I worked more directly with him. Cecil Mackey, from an administrative point of view, I would say is an administrator's administrator. He respected your area of expertise. If there was a problem or an issue that needed, you came in, you were expected to be able to array what the alternatives are, explain which alternative you were recommending and why. It was like taking your final exam type of thing. But once a decision was made, you didn't have to look over your shoulder as to whether he was going to change his mind or whatever. You knew you had backing, you could just take and run and go with it, you know. Mm-hmm. And in that regard, I still have a very good relationship with Cecil and Claire, and I have a lot of respect for him and the way he ran and worked with his administrators. John DiBiagio is a good friend, but totally different. John, again, respected the way your expertise and the way you ran, but you seldom had any interaction with him. He was external more, raising funds and so on, and so you dealt more with the provost, and in that case, David Scott, so it was a whole different kind of administrative structure, and by that time, I was also working more with Roger Wilkinson and worked through Roger more than directly with the president, but still I had a social relationship with John too, so that I always had to make sure that to keep and respect the line of authority, even though I had a social relationship and I could have worked more directly with him, mm-hmm. I had to respect the fact that I was working through Roger Wilkinson and the provost. So, mm-hmm. you know, you have those kind of issues. Peter is a whole different kind of president from any of the others that I've ever worked with. Peter is much more involved in everything. Wants very much more to be involved in the decision making. He personally gets involved with the union leadership, is a very different model to work for.
Do you see any holdover from his experience in the White House in personnel when he was with Dick Cheney? Is there a continuation there in terms of?
I don't think so. I wouldn't have seen that. The one issue that Peter's experience in the federal government when he first came in led him to believe that he would find the same kind of public employee here that he found in the federal government, and he was not very supportive of that kind of. And early on, I had to say to him, no, you know, you've got to reserve your judgment. This is different. Mm-hmm. Our unions are different than federal unions. Our employees are different than federal employees. It's a different kind of environment. This is a university environment. And he did. I mean, he withheld judgment. He learned for himself. And he became, I think, a great supporter of the staff employee when he really found out what they were doing and how they were doing and how we were staffed. And his perception early on was that we were probably overstaffed and we had a lot of people who weren't doing their jobs and so on. And he found out that that really wasn't the case, mm-hmm. and that that we did have a high level of productivity among the staff employees and so on. Became very supportive. Peter is very focused on finance and on money. And so most everything, you know, at one point or another comes down and equates to cost and to money, which is very different than, I'll take DiBiagio, for instance, who was very focused on people and relationships and building relationships with people, and so they're just extremely different personalities.
Did you have any contact with President Hanna in his retirement years?
Only passing, not much. In fact, I probably heard more about Dr. Hanna from Jack Breslin than I did anybody else. You know, we were housed for a long time over in the same building, over in the Nesbitt building. He had an office there, but I really didn't get to know him much at all.
Mm-hmm. The certainly the history of this university was shaped, obviously, significantly by President Hanna, and especially by the generation of faculty and students of following World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And you were in your job when many of those people retired.
Yep.
Could you talk a little bit about that? How did they collectively, as a cohort, is there anything you can say about how they faced retirement?
Yeah. It's rather my relationship today. I still have part of my appointment is with the administration to be the liaison between administration and retirees. Okay, so I still have contact with the retirees, and I meet with the retirees association. I go to their gatherings in Florida every year and talk to them, and I have a lot of connection with the retirees. And because we paid their benefits, health benefits, ours was the main office of contact for retirees, and still is. Years ago, they came to me and wanted some improvement in their benefit package or whatever, and I said, you know, it's real hard to sell that we should be getting more when you're already gone. And I said, if there was some way that you could provide service back to the university on an ongoing basis, you know, that was visible to show that you still were adding value. And that was when they formed the Retiree Service Corps, which still exists today, where you can call and get retirees to come help with your event or whatever kind of thing. Then they said to me, well, you know, we have this organization, and they'd had a retirees organization. It was a retirees men's club, actually, at one time. And I said, you know, you're going to need to be open to staff employees and to women. You know, so they changed it to Retirees Association. And then I provided them an office over in my operation, and they still have an office there to this day. And so that solidified that contact between the retirees and HR. Over the years, as they would stop by the benefits office to change beneficiaries or do something, they'd stop in, and they'd come in and sit down on the couch and tell me their war stories. In many cases, told me about what they did during the Second War and how this translated back to Michigan State. And I mean, some fascinating stories of, you know, people who were faculty here who had been responsible for the whole getting food to the troops, for instance, and so on. And other kinds of relationships. And many of them would tell me the stories of how they came here after the war and how, in fact, in many cases, John Hanna personally recruited them and so on. And he was very involved with bringing faculty here. And I guess, you know, even just prior to my time, he met every new faculty as they came every fall and got to know them, and what they'd see them. He'd see him later and ask them how their son was or their whatever. I mean, you know, he was, and they would tell these stories. And I wish I'd had the tape recorder going then too, because I mean, they're fascinating stories. But some of them are still around, and I still hear some of those stories. I mean, H. Owen Reed is still a good friend, and he's out in Green Valley, Arizona, part of the music faculty here, and you know, world class composer and all. But he tells me that when he came on the faculty here, he came out of the background in the Ozarks and then down into Louisiana and so on, and how, you know, he played jazz and was how partly how he, I guess, helped himself through school and so on. But when he came on the music faculty here, he was made real clear to him that real musicians didn't play jazz, and he wasn't to be involved with that, and so on. Mm. And, you know, he tells this story. Now we have a whole jazz program in our music school, you know. But those kinds of stories of how things changed and what happened, and of course I have a joint appointment in the College of Education, and over the years, knowing and working with many of those faculty, and how at one time Michigan State turned out more teachers by number than any other school in the country, and that was the focus then of our College of Education was. And so field work was a big issue, going out and doing weekend workshops with administrators and counselors and so on. And watching that whole change to a much more research-focused college and so on, watching those kinds of changes take place over time. The whole development of the medical schools here, you know, that was all happening as I came on board, and how the medical schools were developing, and you know, that was a major shift in this university, bringing on the professional schools and eventually law school and so on from what it had been before. But sitting and listening to the retirees tell these stories, and now, you know, when I came into my position in 72, we had, I think it was between 600 and 700 retirees. We now have over 3,600 retirees. I mean, living retirees. And, you know, that's a huge shift. That wave, first of all, you've got, they're living longer, for one thing, but that is your Second World War group, the people who came here after the Second World War, Korean War, and now Vietnam War people who are retiring. There's a huge reservoir. In fact, one thing I did 5 years ago, maybe 6 years ago, is when this project was getting started for the history, one of the people from the Terry Denbaugh's office came down to the retiree gathering in Florida and talked about this and invited all the people who were there to share their stories and so on. But a lot, you know, a lot of those people are still around and still telling their story.
When you mentioned your job history before you came to Michigan State, and it seems like from the people that I've talked with, a very common pattern. People come here. Did you anticipate when you came in 72 that this would be the place you would retire from?
No. My whole model was, you know, at that point I'd stayed, I think, 2.5 years in my, and my thought was I'd be here for a while. Even after I was here for a while, I mean, candidate on presidencies and, you know, vice presidencies at other places and so on. I was very picky about geography, where I would go, and so I wasn't, you know, I limited my opportunities in that regard, and it wasn't a matter so much that I was unhappy here, it was just one more mountain I hadn't climbed yet, and when the phone rings and a headhunter calls you, sure, you know, why not, type of thing. You know, it became a good place for me professionally. Throughout all the years that I was in my administrative position, I continued my professional work. I'm a labor arbitrator, have stayed active, actually in the field. You know, as I tell people, I was one of the few administrators who practiced in my academic field. You know, most administrators have to give up their academic field when they become an administrator and have great difficulty going back to it, if at all. When I decided to come back to the faculty to teach. It was, you know, I was going back to teach the same thing I'd been doing, you know. And I, you know, I have to, one of the worries I have to do is to keep control of the war stories. I can't tell too many of those in class. But you know, I've been a labor arbitrator and still am throughout this whole time. And, you know, there was always this question about, if not spoken out there about, well, don't you have a full-time job? And, you know, the issue at that point was, yeah, but I have a faculty job too, and a faculty, I have a right for a day a week kind of thing. Eventually, that policy even got passed for executives to have a day a week. Uh-huh. But you know, as I pointed out to anybody, that a day a week didn't mean you didn't do the work. It just meant that you did the work on Saturday or on the night. I mean, the work didn't go away. It was still there. Mm-hmm. But because of those contacts over the years, what I was able to do often was reach right out and grab hold of a person in the field that I'd been working with. I mean, Sam Baker became known to me because he was the director of personnel in Pontiac, and I was arbitrating in Pontiac, was impressed by the way he handled things, and so when I had an opening here, I picked up the phone and called him and said, "Ever thought of leaving Pontiac?" You know, that's how he got here. Mm-hmm. And there have been many other incidences of the same kind of thing. The other thing that was most valuable was that I could go out and deal in somebody else's problem and come back to my own staff and say, "What are we doing about this? Let's fix this before we have a problem in this." And it kept me involved in the real world that I wouldn't have had a chance to do. But where else could you have done that? I couldn't have done that if I had left the university. I mean, you couldn't do that in business. Mm-hmm. And you know, the opportunity that really intrigued me, I've been on 78 doctoral committees. I've been on, you know, I've had the arbitration work that I've done. I've been able to do teaching. I've been able to do workshops and speeches. You know, the variety that you get of opportunities working in a university, you simply don't get in other places. And, you know, that kind of becomes addictive after a time.
What are you teaching now?
Collective bargaining.
Oh, okay. The yeah. Graduate level course?
Graduate level. Yeah. Yep. This afternoon, actually, 3 to 6. Yeah. And, but I'm doing workshops. In fact, we have a workshop coming up here in October on healthcare issues. I'm putting together a national conference for next spring on the future of employment-based healthcare. So I'm taking the stuff that I've worked on that's still current hot stuff and taking my contacts and my background that I've built up over the years and now using it in more of an academic setting. But I still have contact. You know, I was over in HR yesterday. I mean, I'm still there if they want to talk to me or bounce something off me or whatever. Mm-hmm. I just don't have to do it every day. And it's not my responsibility anymore.
In looking back at your 30 years here at Michigan State, 30 plus, is there anything that just stands out in your mind about the university, about the history of it the last few years?
Well, one of the things that happened years ago, I had a colleague at the University of Illinois who was my counterpart at the University of Illinois. He eventually went on to be my counterpart at Duke. But when he was at Illinois, he was working on his doctorate. And it was in the early 80s when we were having all the budget cuts across all the schools, not unlike today. And his research project was to go to every Big Ten school and interview a cross-section of faculty, administrators, students, and support staff about how the cuts were handled and the whole process worked. After he did this, he called me and he said, "Keith," he said, "I just need to tell you, Michigan State is a unique place." He says, "It's different than any other Big Ten school." He said, I went to them all, and he said, "No place were the faculty and the students and the staff as concerned about the outcome of their institution as a whole, were more involved and concerned about their institution, nor were they as open to speak about and talk about their institution as Michigan State. He said it was so different than the other schools. He said, you just need to know about it. He said, I don't know what you've done, but the people there are so dedicated to that institution, and they're so open and concerned about beyond their own discipline for the school. And, you know, that, I guess, is the thing that stands out in my mind. It goes back to Breslin's, these are our people. These are our people, but these people care deeply about this institution. And that's true, I think, whether it's faculty, whether it's staff. There is a tremendous dedication to this place. It's like they've earned a piece of it, you know, over their years. And I think it, in part, is it's reciprocated in the sense that I think the institution has taken care of them, has looked after them. And if anything stands out, I think it's that. Mm-hmm. That, you know, we talk about this being the people's university and, you know, out of the land grant tradition and so on. And I really do believe that's true. I worry sometimes that in an effort to become more the research model university, we might lose that. We might forget our roots. But as long as people keep remembering the roots and that what the land grant school is all about, I think it'll be okay. As long as we remember that people aren't interchangeable, dispensable parts, that each one of them has a unique value that they've brought here, and that when someone leaves or retires or whatever, you can't replace them. You can put someone in that and give them those jobs, but those people have developed a uniqueness here. And I think this school has done a great job at that over the years, and recognizing that. And, you know, I would hope that that continues.
Well, I want to thank you on behalf of the project. I appreciate your time and especially your insights.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.